Tim?
Yes, all right. So welcome, thanks for coming. I think if anyone missed it, but Michael said this a few times, that it's supposed to be interruptible, and I'm going to finish after an hour, so if we ended up discussing something else, that's 100% fine with me. So in the meantime, I'll present what we're doing, looking at epistasis and its role in influencing adaptation. I promise there's new stuff in here. If you've heard some of this stuff before, it will roll about a third of the way through to, and into new stuff. So bear with me. Just a little bit of context that we had some of this morning. We care about epistasis because it influences adaptation. For example, it determines the fitness landscapes and they determine evolutionary outcomes. So very kind of simple toy examples. If the landscape's smooth, then even if populations' genotypes start in different places on those landscapes, they are likely to end up in some kind of similar position. If structure of the landscape is more complicated, if it's rugged, if this kind of reciprocal sign epistasis that we heard about this morning, if that's common, or at least influential, then even populations that start, replicate populations starting in the same place on this genotype plane can end up in different places. So one reason why we care about epistasis and how it affects these landscapes. The new stuff that I will at least tell you something about is an extension where we have evolved populations not just in one landscape, so one environment, so we have one landscape, but in a fluctuating environment, and there different things can happen. We can, for example, break constraints if the environment changes, if the landscape changes, and maybe manage to move a population to a different peak. And we have some evidence kind of beginning towards that happening. So these, obviously, are metaphors. We make things a little more concrete now. We manipulate specific mutations. And again, we heard this, but I think it's important to be clear about the null model. When I'm talking about epistasis, it's a deviation between an expected fitness of a genotype and what we actually observe. That expectation, I think increasingly, at least to me, is not super clear what that should be. And I think an interesting area that things are moving is one being a little more agnostic towards what that expectation is and letting the data inform that a little bit. But for now, because we're dealing with fitness affecting mutations and because we kind of have a natural reference point in evolution experiments that I'm talking about, I'm going to use kind of an old-fashioned definition. And that is, if we have a reference genotype, so here, gray, for us, that's going to be the ancestral genotype in evolution experiments, and we can measure the fitness effect of some number of mutations, then our expectation of those mutations, if they were to be combined, is simply the multiplicative product of the individual fitness effects on that reference background. Okay, so if we observe fitness value of some mutation combination and it's not different from what we expect, and we say epistasis is zero, that is consistent with some kind of smooth landscape where replicate populations, even different, starting at different places, will converge to a similar fitness. It doesn't have to get much more complicated to affect that simple picture, or at least to affect how we expect evolution adaptation to unfold. For example, here, if our expectation of two mutations, if what we actually observe is just a little less than that, we say that's negative epistasis. The fitness that we expect is a little less than the fitness that we, sorry, is more than the fitness that we expect. Our expectation is less. Then that has an influence on adaptation. One example is of how that can happen is from this experiment or from this analysis by Mike Weiser and Rich Lenski. So this plot is showing the fitness of the 12 Lenski lines over their first 50,000 generations of evolution in this simple constant environment, replicates that all started the same genotype. What they did was compare two models of adaptation or of fitness trajectory. I'm trying to explain that fitness trajectory. First model without any epistasis, that's the red model, and then a model with this kind, a special case of this kind of epistasis, that's the blue line. What they did was train these models to the first 20,000 generations and then ask whether or not they could predict the next 30,000 that they had here. And you can see clearly that the model with epistasis does a better job of predicting the future given that initial information. So two points. One, even this kind of fairly subtle and not really dramatic epistasis that we heard about with the trimethic prim resistance has an influence. Second point that I think is important and that has motivated kind of our experimental work is that fundamentally there's a difficulty in taking this kind of model fit to data and working backwards to say, or taking this data and working backwards to say what's the best model, what model really truly explains what's going on. This model can do it. It doesn't mean it's the only model that can do it. And for example, Michael with the same data has shown that other models can also do a pretty good job. And actually with additional information, with knowledge about how mutations accumulate, maybe even a better job. So that's kind of our motivation for really trying to do experiments. Kind of to start at the beginning and just to set a background, we took one of the 12 Lenski populations that's shown here, looked at the first part of what had gone on in this population, five mutations have fixed, and made the network of those five mutations, made those genotypes and then measured the fitness of each of those genotypes. So that's what's shown here. And just a couple of points that I want to make that we can tell from this network. One, epistasis was common. So in about half the cases of genotypes that had multiple mutations so that we could have potentially seen epistasis, about half the time we did. About half the time we couldn't predict the genotype fitness by knowing the individual mutation effects. Second point I want to make that I'll come back to is that in this network, in this little landscape, there's only one adaptive trajectory. The population only did one thing. It only got from the ancestral genotype to this most fit genotype here through one path, and that's the one down on the right. That path includes four genotypes and multiple mutations. Okay, so those are the only combinations of these mutations that were actually exposed to selection. All these other things, despite the fact they are individually mutations that were selected, those combinations were never exposed to selection. So I'm going to come back to that, but it turns out to be important. So we had this data, we were looking for patterns. The pattern that we found...
Can I ask a random question? How long did it take you to make all those mutations?
This is a long time ago, so it took us 6 years.
How long do you think it would take you today?
Part time. I mean, it depends.
Like if you were working on it just...
Yeah. I mean, the problem with this kind of stuff, I mean, one problem is E. coli, making precise single nucleotide changes and being confident that nothing else has happened is a pain. I guess now we can sequence stuff, so it makes it easier from that perspective. But I mean, every one of these we would make 3, 4, 5. Often we would revert them to make sure fitness, that reverted phenotype, genotype is the same as what we started with, that kind of thing. Yeah. But it's always going to be more difficult than yeast.
Well, just
introducing the mutations is a pain. Although we certainly have more tools now than we did 10 years ago. So the pattern we found was this one of diminishing returns that we ended up, and now others have called diminishing returns. So what I'm showing here, the points are the genotypes on that network from the last slide. And I'm showing the relationship between the fitness that we expect those genotypes to have, the product of the individual mutations, and the deviation from that expectation, this measure of epistasis that we have. And you can see this negative relationship that means the more of these individually beneficial mutations we put together, increasingly the further behind, the lower the fitness that we actually get out of those mutations is. They're getting in each other's way. There's some antagonism there. So this, you know, is one example in E. coli, simple environment. Michael's done work showing this in yeast with Sergey. People have shown this kind of antagonism in bacteriophage and other bacteria, methylobacterium. I want to show you just one more example from what we've done, where we saw the same kind of pattern amongst much more varied strains. So instead of strains that differ by at most 5 mutations, what we did was take a selection of natural isolate E. coli. So here's a phylogeny of 96 or so, 90 natural isolate E. coli strains that we have. And we added in 4 out of the 5, for technical reasons, of the mutations that we found in the Lenski lines. So this is the Lenski E. coli. These dots indicate other strains of E. coli that we added these mutations into. I think we heard, maybe Bruce said this morning, E. coli is incredibly variable. Of, I think, in total 28 strains that we manipulated, they share 1,300 genes out of an average of about 4,600. So really, really different genotypes. And yet, when we measure the fitness effect of introducing these mutations, trying to summarize that here, what we found was that our goal was to try and explain, one, does background genotype influence the benefit conferred by getting a new mutation through this kind of artificial horizontal transfer? And if so, what explains the variation that we see? And the main, or at least our best predictor was how well the recipient strains grew in the first place. Okay, so here I'm showing the growth rate of recipients before they got the mutation and the benefit that that mutation gave to them. And we see this negative relationship. I won't go into it, but I mean, the other candidates that we had were phylogeny, phylogenetic signal, measured either by the genes that they had in common or the genes that only some of them had. Or we had a measure of kind of a proxy for recent past ecological selection. And this result is trying to summarize those 4 potential predictors of mutation effect. Fitness, this proxy for ecology or different measures of phylogeny. This is a technique called partial least squares regression, which is kind of a principal components approach. And this is fairly typical, this result, that of the components that explain variation, usually the component that explains the most variation is mostly made up of this growth rate effect. So it's certainly not saying that phylogeny doesn't matter, but I think surprisingly that growth rate does matter and matters the most of the things that we looked at. Tell you not convinced. Yeah. I mean, statistically, it's strong, and you know, it's like 25% that it's explaining something like that. Even if you take those out, it's still there. I mean, I take your point. It's something on the order of 20% explained, something like this, maybe a little more. So obviously, it's not everything, but it's pretty hard to expect. I mean, to my mind, given how divergent the strains are, I think any signal is quite surprising.
What were the magnitude of the selection coefficients associated with the original mutations? And what were those? Did you get, to get selection coefficients, comparable selection coefficients for all the different strains?
Yeah, I struggle to remember. So these, basically the first two and the fourth are about 10, 11, 12% in the ancestor, and this is in the original experiment, this is one or two. Comparable but exaggerated, I guess. This, I mean, the means may be kind of similar, but the variation was much higher. And some of them, so for example, this maybe so got up to about 20% and down to zero. This, something like that, maybe 15 to minus
so 5. So it's not just the, the static effects. So you can imagine one, I mean, if they were, if these were highly specific to the E. coli strain that you use, that they might have very weak effects in different genetic backgrounds, but the epistatic interactions would be the same. That's what I'm trying to get my head around. So, but what you're saying is no, in fact, they were almost, they were comparably large effect.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that's a little strong, but certainly a lot of them were definitely very significantly beneficial. It's not just the variation, there's flavors of deleterious.
It's perhaps the question, why are they segregating?
Well, because they're not living in a glucosyl flask, I guess. I mean, a good point is just, you know, how environmentally dependent are they? And I won't show you, but they are. A lot of them aren't beneficial in other, even lab environments.
If you put them in different environments and look at, you know, at reorders, growth rate, so...
Perfect.
Why do you use growth rate as opposed to growth and fitness?
Well, because for these, there's no reference. I mean, I have a strain, but they're all producing toxins and so there is no kind of natural relative to what, I can't compete them with anything and have a kind of fair competition.
So this was all in DM with 25 micrograms of glucose, all of these?
It was. So this is what Michael said. This is obviously already complicated, but different environments, same set of mutations. And if you just look at the kind of scatter plots, a bunch of points are clearly deleterious there.
But I wonder, I guess, two questions. I mean, A, I can't really tell from this plot. I assume you want to tell me that there's still diminishing returns in each of these environments.
I'd like to, but in about 7, maybe 6 of 8, that's true.
Okay. Another question is, let's say, right, in the first plot that you showed us before, right, there's this weak negative correlation, 25% of variance explained, there's a lot of variance that isn't explained.
Yeah.
If you look at how far away from the line you are, let's say you have a strain where this mutation has an unusually positive effect given its growth rate or something like that, does that information tell you across all the other environments as well that it's going to...
I don't know. I mean...
It's like a question about how much information there is in the...
Yeah, I think maybe... I mean, so this stuff we haven't measured in any other environment. So I can't tell you that. The other stuff where we have, actually almost all the variation around that best fit line is explained by the presence of absence of one mutation of the five. So really there's not very much else left to explain.
But here that's probably not true.
Here that's not true. Yeah, I mean here it would be something interesting to do.
I mean here, it looks here, for example, like the RBS mutation is just relatively flat across.
Yeah.
Whereas PICF is a very strong.
Yeah. Yeah, individually, these, I think the first two individually are strong. There's also more of them, I think. Ribose individually, we don't see an effect.
I mean, don't, for example, you know that SPOT affects lag more than growth?
No, SPOT affects growth more than lag. PYKF.
I mean, how much? How much of fitness is captured by your growth rate? Like,
well,
have they been broken down? What these mutations do on like lag and growth rate, etc.
Yeah.
Is that why the correlation isn't very strong? Because there's other aspects of fitness that you're not capturing.
So I haven't been clear. Our measure of starting fitness is growth rate, because that's all we can do. I mean, I guess I don't know how to measure lag. I think that's a difficult thing to do.
It's an easy way of measuring fitness, but it's clearly not as good as a competition.
But this is a competition assay. The mutation affects the competition assay.
So you're saying much of the variation is in growth rate, in fitness.
Of what we can look at, yeah. Right. Yeah. So the mutation affects head-to-head competitions.
Right.
What we're trying to say, where you start from, does that affect it there? We're only looking at growth rate. Yeah. The rest of your question, generally speaking, do these things have kind of consistent effects across growth curves or different effects? I think different. For this, it may well be relevant. But if anything, it's going to make for a weaker relationship, I would have thought.
So you actually took all of those 21 strains, is that what you did? So you reverted mutations?
We added...
Head-to-head competition effect, you said?
Yeah. So for each one of these, so for a natural isolate strain, this one when we added the four mutations into, we then competed the strain that had the mutation added against the one. So we also added a neutral marker into everything to keep them separate and did the same kind of competitions that we always do.
Sorry, Tim, I know you're probably desperate to get on to the next slide. Were any of these particular SNPs segregating in your phylogeny? Did you find those mutants? Or did you look for them?
I can't remember. I don't think so, but that's not a comprehensive answer. Well, one thing I didn't say, we only move these mutations into strains that otherwise had a gene identical to the lab strain, so that we weren't confounding between gene epistasis. Right. So if there was any differences, I would have ditched it from the beginning.
Right.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay. That's the question.
I don't know. I don't think it does. In E. coli, are these lab selected mutations segregating? I'm not sure.
That question. I meant for the ones that you asked. So basically, you've got identical sequence to the original wild type.
Yeah.
From the original experiment.
Yeah.
In all these strains.
All right. We were happy enough. We had this pattern of diminishing returns. And then, or actually kind of before we wrap this up fully, three papers came out that were interesting and that really made us revise how we were thinking about this, especially given we were interested in epistasis because of its influence on adaptation. The point that these papers made was that selection can bias epistasis. And you have to be careful when you're making some measurements that what you're measuring is going to be representative of what's going on during adaptation. The logic is actually kind of simple. So to kind of represent it, this is results from a model, the NK model of adaptation, but more or less this holds with something like the geometric model and some other kind of more specialized models. The idea is that we all know if we look at the distribution of fitness effects of mutations without selection in some genotype, then we get some broad distribution. If we look at the distribution of effects, the red line that actually get fixed, that's shifted towards higher values because mutations that are beneficial are more likely to be selected. If we do the same kind of thing looking at epistasis, The argument is if the fitness effect for mutation depends on background, so that sometimes it's more or less beneficial, then it's more likely to be selected in backgrounds where it confers a higher benefit. Right? Higher benefit, more likely to escape loss by drift when it's rare, to outcompete other things. Turns out when you run something like this model or various other models, make these kind of landscapes in multiple runs, look at patterns of epistasis between everything. That's the red line here. We although you can't get it directly from here, you do see a pattern of diminishing returns epistasis when you're putting everything together, all these beneficial mutations and all possible orders. But when you look at just the orders that actually get selected, that trajectory, then there's a bias towards positive epistasis.
So it's not just that the ones with higher fitness effects are more likely to be epistatic.
No, because it's the same mutations. It's that.
It could be that epistasis is more common among mutations of larger effects.
Well, so this is the exact, you know, the same networks. The solid red line is a subset of the dashed one. The same mutations are involved. They're just fewer combinations. So it's the combinations of those mutations which is being biased towards positive epistasis.
So the inference there is that the observation of diminishing returns in all the other lines is not that surprising.
Well, yeah. I mean, whether or not it's surprising, it's a caution that you shouldn't take what you see from this kind of possibles and extrapolate to the one trajectory that you really care about, which is what most experiments do, because it's difficult to make all these things. They try and get as much data as they can from.
But then it's somewhat more surprising, if I'm understanding correctly, that the observed trajectory has diminishing returns.
Well, that's what we haven't measured, really. I mean, what we do is look at the whole network.
Uh-huh. And but you've got the
we have the one.
You've got the one, yeah.
We've got the one, but you end up with very little data to test anything, which is the problem. And as far as I know, no experiments have more than that. So if selection biases epistasis, then it's important to look at epistasis that's being selected among selected combinations and mutations. That's the bottom line. So the experiment that we did I'm going to kind of skip a few things. The experiment that we did was to take one trajectory that we know happened from the Lansky experiment. We re-evolved populations from each of the first five steps and then from two steps from along that trajectory. So we kind of have these extra replay populations derived from along a trajectory. And then we're looking at what happens among these replay populations and how it changes along this trajectory. Okay, so there's a couple of things we can do. First, we can look at how fitness change. All these were evolved for 1,000 generations. We can look at how the change in fitness depended on the fitness of the original founder. When we do that, the black points are means of these replay populations, the colored ones are different steps along the original trajectory. We find what's fitted as a power law function that you'd expect under diminishing returns, but clearly we don't have power to rule other things out. There's some kind of decelerating relationship, but we know this already. What we also did was when we did these evolution experiments, we embedded a neutral marker in there. We can look at the dynamics of that marker and estimate mutational parameters going on from each of these, from replicate data from each founder, and a kind of very poor cousin to the kind of barcoding experiments that Sasha does. So when we do this, we can estimate the effective beneficial mutation rate of each of our 9 founder genotypes and the effective selection coefficient of the next mutational step occurring in each of these, in the replicate population starting from each founder. We find that starting founder fitness, how far you are along this trajectory, doesn't affect beneficial mutation rate as far as we can estimate it along the section that we have. But a pretty clear relationship there. The fitter the founder, the smaller the effect of new beneficial mutations that substitute in that population. Right? So probably not unexpected here. this maybe is, but there are pretty big error bars on all these estimates. Okay. So consistent with diminishing returns along these trajectories that we're looking at. The direct experiment, though, what we did was sequence clones started from the founder genotype 5 mutations along this trajectory. We had 16 clones sequenced, or at least 16 clones that had mutations that we could transfer. And we moved those mutations back into its direct progenitor, their direct progenitor, and to the ancestor. Our prediction is if diminishing returns is dominant, then these mutations would typically have larger effects in the ancestor, the lower fitness, than in this genotype here, that had already accumulated 5 mutations. If positive epistasis was dominant, this is the prediction of these models, then we expected these mutations that we found here would have a larger effect here, because that's the context in which they were selected, than they would in the ancestor, where all that context is ripped out, or at least some of it is ripped out. Okay? So the transfer mutations are shown in the black points on this plot. Dashed line is equivalent fitness in the two genotypes. You can see that most mutations that had a differential effect are more fit in the ancestor than they were in the evolved genotype. Right, so this is support for diminishing returns, okay, along this adaptive path. Just for reference, the red points are the same experiment done in a simulation. So there's clearly something lacking in those simulations. All right. I'm going to just skip ahead just a tiny bit. So that's more or less a kind of nice clean picture, and then things get a bit more complicated. So one concern is that still we're dealing with genotypes when we're looking at diminishing returns along adaptive trajectories. They're pretty closely related to each other. So we wanted to look at slightly more diverse genotypes, or comparisons that were slightly more diverse. The way we chose to do that was to look at reverting earlier mutations that occurred along adaptive trajectories. Just technically, that's an easier thing to do. So the mutation that we looked at was in a gene called PYKF, which encodes an enzyme that catalyzes the last step of glycolysis, so kind of a key metabolic gene involved in a lot of processes, including its substrate, PEP, is something required for glucose uptake in this environment. So an important metabolic step. The 12 Lenski lines, all of them substituted mutations in this gene. And other experiments started with that ancestor strain, other E. coli strains. It's common to get mutations in this gene. So it's clearly a significant target. What's kind of interesting is that the protein PYKF forms a homotetramer. That's the functional structure. Mutations, when we map onto that structure, really are pretty diverse. It's spread throughout the gene. They localize to an allosteric site in the enzyme. They localize, there's a cluster there, there's a cluster around the active site, and there's a cluster around another kind of regulatory domain. Okay. So the first thing we did was take these mutations. We have 8 non-synonymous mutations in this gene. One of them occurred several times in the Lenski experiment. And transfer them to the ancestor and ask what the fitness effect there was. And I think for us, a little surprisingly, the effect was pretty much indistinguishable. The non-synonymous, 8 non-synonymous mutations had effects pretty close to 10%. This is a loss of function deletion mutation. So common mutations spread throughout an enzyme, but not simply loss of function mutations. Again, our interest in what happens during the evolutionary process And again, the expectation or the two possibilities, if diminishing returns is influential, then we expect the effect of these mutations to diminish over time. Right? If we were to take these mutations that fixed early in this experiment from clones isolated at later time points, we would expect the fitness benefit to shrink, so the effect of taking the mutation out would be smaller and smaller. If these models have some value, if the predictions of these models are predicting positive epistasis where late mutations depend on the earlier mutations for their benefit, if that's true, that predicts some kind of entrenchment where those early mutations become increasingly important over evolutionary time. Right? More and more later mutations depend on them. If you rip it out, then you destroy more and more of those positive interactions. You get a bigger cost. Okay. So, what do you reckon? We remove the mutation from strains at 20,000 generations, so on the order of 40 mutational steps from the ancestor. We got just a mess. Right? In 11 populations, we had about half the time removing this mutation had, these early occurring mutations had bigger benefits after 20,000 generations than they did at the start. So not what we expect in the diminishing returns. Some of the time, they become essentially neutral, or as far as we can measure, neutral.
So can you talk quickly about whether these are different kinds of mutations, transitions, transversions, indels?
They're non-synonymous mutation, except for one indel. For us, we manipulated deletion. I can't remember who's the transition, who's the transversion, to be honest. But they're all non-synonymous mutations.
Do you know what they did to the activity of the enzyme and the inhibition by
Yes. So we're collaborating with a biochemist who's done a lot of work looking at their effects on structure and kinetics and stability and all these kinds of things. And we have a kind of explanation for what might tie things together, but it's not finished stuff yet. But we could.
The scatterer is going to be explained by properties
of the enzyme? No. No, not any property we've measured. It's not. Yeah. So this is a kind of snapshot. So, we had a nice clear pattern of diminishing returns. When we've looked out a bit further, now things that are 40 mutations along a path, it's disappeared. I guess we're kind of gluttons for punishment. So.
How confident are you in these error intervals? If you just average over them, you get pretty much the same average.
Yeah, I mean, everything was done in the same experimental block. I mean, it's true the errors are not small, but I think the signal is real.
The errors are between the 11 strains, right? So it's not just measurement error.
It's not just measurement error, no. So this is a snapshot. At 40 steps, roughly speaking, 20,000 generations along pathways, these early mutations. Some populations had grown to depend on them. Some, they've become redundant. What we did was look to try and see, how this happens a bit more dynamically. We took 6 populations pretty much arbitrarily and reverted again these early occurring by about 2,000 generations. Michael's probably got the fine scale data on this. Reverted these early occurring mutations along this time course up to 50,000 mutations out. And what we see, I don't know what the explanation is. So again, I've shown you data at zero. Things are pretty consistent, about 10%. I showed you data at 20,000 generation in the last slide. again, these are only 6 of the 11 populations from the last slide, but much more variable, sometimes above, sometimes below, the effects during the ancestor. By 50,000 generations, everything has really converged again to effects that, by and large, are lower than they were in the ancestor. I don't have any explanation for this. Beyond something I might be about you know, positive interactions being rare but influential, perhaps overlaid on a trend of negative epistasis diminishing.
So the 20,000 generation points are the ones from the previous slide.
They're 6 of 11 from the previous slide.
Right.
Well, I mean, they're remeasured as a different experimental block, so they won't line up exactly.
Either 5 or 6 of 11, in this case 6. And these are just the non-mutators?
No. Some of them are mutators.
Yeah, right. Why do you choose these 6?
Because they have two reasons. They have mutations that were easy to screen for, easy to manipulate, and because we could introduce neutral markers into strains, it becomes really hard to manipulate strains that have been evolving for a while.
Right, in many of these lines, we found that frequency-dependent interactions arise. And I wonder, right, when you make these mutations in an evolved clone, you make it in some random clone, right? And I wonder if you're just getting a lot of variability and you put it, because of the frequency-dependent selection, essentially, you put it in one strain or the other. If you happen to get one of the other types, when you compete it against your ancestor, you get an anomalous fitness measurement.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a random clone, but it's the same random clone that everyone uses. It's, like the clone from, just in terms of keeping things repeatable. Obviously you see, looking at those fine resolution, mutation dynamics, you can clearly see frequency-dependent selection. I'm not sure how much of that is apparent in competitions against the ancestor. All right, so contemporary things are interacting, whether they're both just as good against the ancestor.
It's easily testable, though, right? I mean, you can just do a fitness assay where you measure, where you start them at 90, 10, and then 10.
Yeah.
Maybe the relevant interactions are not being captured here because you should be competing against whatever it is, the genetic background that you just...
That would be the perfect experiment.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've mentioned this to Rich a number of times, and he always tries to weasel his way out of it by saying, on average, things are additive over the 60,000 generations of the experiment.
What's additive?
Well, the fitness increases.
Okay.
They look for non-transitive effects and so on and so forth.
But,
I mean, Mike, I don't know if, how far you've pushed this with the data that you got. I mean, on the surface of it, there's got to be tons of ecology going on. I mean, just by inspecting those plots that you've generated. And that could potentially, basically by 50,000 generations here, you've got this is going to sound a horrible word to say, it sounds a little bit 1980s electronica erasure of any historical effect, right? You've got historical effects.
Yeah.
Or, all along the way, basically starting at time zero.
I'm not sure. I mean, these clones with no manipulation against the ancestor are still, much fitter.
Yeah,
something similar to what
variance,
you get when you look at the
clones,
population.
Right? The variance among clones.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean,
it's like they've found a peak.
Found a peak where this early mutation no longer matters much.
Yeah. Or it has some average effect beyond that. It doesn't. Yeah, by 50,000 generations, the average effect, not the epistatic effect, but actually. Maybe I'm misunderstanding that. But anyway, it could be that this is misleading because the competitions are all against the ancestor, which is now.
I think that's a very good general point in looking at fitness trajectories over time. I think it's, in general, it's going to be less important in this particular experiment than a lot because of just the lack of potential, not lack of potential, reduced potential for a cold unit. I couldn't see how it could be producing this pattern. Strange things can happen.
I don't think, without knowing something about the ecology, you can't make a prediction about it.
All right. So I wanted to just get to one last little story, talking about an experiment that we're doing now. We started a while ago looking at selection and fluctuating environments. And this is where I think things can get kind of qualitative. The expectations are qualitatively different, can be. So if we select populations in environments where there are trade-offs between them, so that populations can't adapt simultaneously to these environments, I think it sets up the kind of scenario where in one environment a mutation can be selected to be beneficial. If there's an environmental shift, then that mutation can be deleterious. There are trade-offs. In that case, the selection for a second mutation that compensates for that deleterious effect. Right? Not that it has to happen, but from past work we know these things tend to be fairly easy to achieve. And again, not that it has to happen, has to be the case, but often these compensatory mutations are dependent on the initial deleterious mutation, that they're quite specific for that detriment, for the benefit that they confer. Okay? So this sets up a scenario where we expect positive epistasis to be strong. Okay? So I'm going to skip over some stuff. Let me explain the experiment that we have, the evolution experiment. We took the same E. coli strain that Rich did. We evolved six populations in actually a bunch of environments, but four that are relevant here. Glucose only, more or less the same as the Lenski lines. Lactose only. One environment where those two resources fluctuate on a very short time scale. So the strains are basically seeing an average of them. One where they fluctuate on a much longer time scale, about 2,000 generations. So at least in this early part of the experiment, a lot of mutations are going to be seeing only one of the two environments during that period where they're sweeping through the population, which will become less true over time, I imagine. So that's the experiment. We've done a lot of work that I'm going to skip over, demonstrating that there are trade-offs in adaptation to these two environments, which after all are quite similar to each other, but still, populations over time can't adapt simultaneously to both environments. There are costs. So one question we have, although I just skipped over it, is it takes a while for those costs to become apparent. So there's something going on early in this experiment, early being 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 generations, that is allowing generalists to keep up with specialists, allowing strains selected in multiple environments to keep up with strains selected in only one environment, which for me is a little surprising. So our question was whether or not there's some mechanism, the one that I showed before of compensation, this kind of positive epistasis that underlies it, that might be contributing to this success.
Maybe you'll say this, but I mean, presumably most of that initial adaptation that leads to similar patterns in generalists and specialists are domestication mutations.
I will say. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of it is, but we have one example where that's not true. So the kind of case study that we've gone after was motivated by the observation that, again, starting from a common ancestor, well, in replicate populations in lactose only, or in another treatment where they had 2,000 generations in glucose and then they were switched to lactose, what we saw was that the first 1,000 generations of adaptation in lactose, either starting directly from the ancestor or having this history of glucose, we saw different rates of adaptation in lactose comparing those two treatments. From the ancestor, the average of six replicates, average fitness increased 22%. With this history, starting from this new genotype, the rate is now 28%. So it's significant, but it's you know, it's clearly fairly low numbers. So we repeated this experiment. We have 18 ancestor starter populations evolving on lactose, and from each of the six original populations that had this glucose history, we divided to make another six replicates. So now 36 populations evolving in lactose that had this history of having already seen glucose. What we saw, exactly the same as last time. So the red line is populations, naive populations, started from the freezer, no history. That's their adaptation in lactose. Populations that had previously been evolved in glucose and then switched to lactose, their starting fitness is pretty similar, right? But 500,000 generations, they increased to higher levels. So they didn't only increase more rapidly, they also increased to higher levels of fitness. So there's something about this history of selection in glucose that has increased the evolvability of these strains in lactose.
I mean, arguably, maybe one way to think of it would just be there's two things they're adapting to, the general experimental condition and the food. And so they get better at the experimental condition and worse at the food when they evolve in glucose, and worse at lactose specifically when they evolve in glucose. So then it's when you put them in lactose, it's, you know, they just correct the food part, but they've already done the condition part.
That's exactly what we think is happening. Yeah.
But they're also still, I mean, the glucose is still just one step away. So, I mean, if you did it in, say, nitrogen-limited cultures, I imagine you get profoundly different effects. We saw nitrogen effects, very profound.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, you know, if I had done this over again, I probably would have chosen more contrasting environments. But even with the fact that they're pretty similar resources, glucose and lactose, we still see trade-offs. We still see mutations that are beneficial in one, deleterious in the other.
But you sequenced the genomes of the six populations in glucose?
Yeah, yeah. So I'll give me one slide and I'll show you that. So I mean, we have this observation. History in glucose increases evolvability in lactose. First, then we thought, well, before we did this, maybe these populations are diverse. They've evolved in, for 2,000 generations in glucose. Their means may be similar, but they have variation, and maybe there's just a couple of rare good ones, and that's what's getting selected. So we did the same thing again, starting from clones, and we saw the same pattern. So there's something about the genotype that increases evolvability. It's not a function of the population. Second concern we had, or second possibility, whenever anyone says anything about evolvability in bacteria, you think maybe it's a global change in mutation rate. Here's our ancestral mutation rate. Here's a fluctuation test to rifampicin, and we see kind of no sign of change in mutation rate. And now we've done sequencing, and it's kind of no reason to think there would be a change in mutation rate. So the sequencing we did, again, to try and explain this increase in lactose evolvability. Here's a list of the genes that were mutated amongst one clone from each of the original six populations. Okay, so we see multiple mutations, ribose, NADASPRT, ICLR, so these are kind of known targets in other similar experiments. Because this pattern that we're thinking of, this evolvability, seems to be common across this glucose history, six different replicates all show the same kind of pattern, we focused on these mutations because, you know, they occurred in more than one population. We also sequenced clones from populations that had only evolved in lactose, right? So not populations that I've shown you, apart from in the original experimental design. And what we find...
Did you see when you maintained the lactose, were they selecting for constituents?
About half the time.
So they do select for it.
Yeah. Yeah, but even after a long time, about half of the six populations and whenever there's lactose in the environment, about half the time, maybe a little more, they become constitutive. And if they don't, then, and you force them to be, it's no longer beneficial. So there's two routes that.
Yeah, I mean, it's the limitation of the repressor is the issue.
Yeah.
You put them in a chemostat and the instant.
Yeah. Yeah. Becoming constitutive confers a benefit to the ancestor whenever there's lactose around here. Yeah. So I'm only showing you mutations that are relevant to the ones that we saw on lactose. The point is that mutations in these genes, they're beneficial in glucose. We know this, and they occur in parallel populations. They also occur when we only select in lactose. So presumably, and now we know, they're also beneficial in lactose. Right. The interesting one is this one in ICLR, which is common in following glucose selection, and we kind of know why that is. But we never see it following lactose selection. Okay. So what we thought was exactly the kind of mechanism that Michael raised, that maybe this is a mutation that's good for growth in glucose. When you move it to lactose, it's costly. And that cost is masking what would otherwise be the benefit of these mutations, these other mutations in that genotype that are also seen in just lactose selection. Right. So we've got a mix of good things, bad things. The bad thing masks the good things, so the net effect is small. Okay. We can test that part. Sorry, I made this plot on the plane on the way here. So bear with me just a little. Four of the glucose clones had this ICLR mutation. So it's clearly not everything, but it contributes to the pattern we see. When we revert that mutation, so the blue lines are the clones themselves with the evolved ICLR allele. ICLR is a repressor that shuts off genes involved in reorganizing central metabolism, the TCA cycle. So in the evolved clones, they have this mutation. When we revert it, looking at the effects in lactose, we find that that reversion is beneficial. Right? Three out of four times, this one is probably weird that we're going to have to go back and look at. But at least three out of four times, reverting this glucose-selected ICLR allele, measured it in lactose, and that confers a benefit. Right? So costly mutation. When we do the same thing at subsequent time points after the clones have been selected on lactose, now reverting it is deleterious. Right? So it looks as though, I think at least one explanation is that ICLR was selected in glucose where it's beneficial, this population gets moved to lactose, this mutation is now deleterious, it's masking the effects of other mutations there that are by themselves beneficial. But the populations are compensating for this cost. Those compensatory mutations now make ICLR by itself a beneficial mutation. Right? Because removing it means that you're left with compensatory mutations but nothing to compensate, and that's a deleterious organization. So, more to do here, but at least consistent with this idea that a costly mutation selected in one environment is being compensated in a second environment. Compensatory mutations are fairly easy to get and specific, and that creates a positive epistasis and is underlying this evolvability that we see. All right, so I think that's all I had. Thank people. Thank you.